This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes. Also, make sure to check out and subscribe to our YouTube original channel, UCTV Prime, available only on YouTube at youtube.com/UCTV Prime. This UCTV podcast is sponsored in part by Audible.com, your destination for the widest selection of digital audiobooks available, including many by guests you've heard here on UCTV. Audible.com is offering UCTV podcast listeners a free 30-day trial subscription and one free audiobook download. Just visit audibletrial.com/UCTV to sign up. That's audibletrial.com/UCTV. And thanks.
At this point, I would like to introduce our speaker and our moderator. I will start with our speaker. Dr. Panaritos will open this evening with his formal remarks, and Provost Hoekstra will be the moderator who will lead off a question and answer period with the audience. Maybe I will start with Ralph, even if I said, because that's going to be the easiest. Ralph is a distinguished professor of classics. Of course, everybody knows him. He is our provost here at UC Davis since January 1, 2011. As an academic leader, Ralph has made it a priority to foster excellence across a full range of disciplines and to promote equal opportunity, diversity, and inclusion for students, faculty, and staff. And I would like to thank him, really, for rearranging his schedule to do this today. So now I'm honored to introduce my longtime friend and our distinguished guest today, John Panaritos. John is a statistician and professor of probability and statistics at the University of Athens, University of Economics in Athens, Greece. University of Economics and Business in Athens, Greece. He has been a professor there since 1991. And John has served as Greece's Deputy Minister of Education, Lifelong Learning, and Religious Affairs from October 2009 to June 2011. He has served as the education advisor to former Greek Prime Minister George Papandreou and as Greece's representative to the Open Government Partnership. Also, he has served as Vice President of the Network of National Councils of Education of the European Union and President of the National Council of Education and the National Council of Higher Education in Greece. He was born in Kythira, Greece, and received his first degree in mathematics from the University of Athens and advanced degrees from the University of Sheffield and University of Bradford, both in England. With that, I would like to invite him to come forward. Thank you, John.
Thank you. Thank you. Good evening. Thank you, Chancellor, for your kind introduction and for the invitation for me to be here today and to share with you some of my thoughts on public higher education. It is very exciting to be here at a great public university like UC Davis, and I would like to say that I'm not just excited. I'm also proud. I'm proud because I will be speaking at a university where the chancellor is a Greek woman who studied at a Greek university and has become the only Greek woman, as far as I know, to ever have led a top university in the world. So you don't have many instances today to have such an opportunity to be proud of. We don't have. The success of Linda Katechi is one of the many success stories of a system that helped many bright young people to make the best of their potential, even though their families did not possess the financial means to fully support their education. It all happened because of a major political initiative taken in 1964. The decision then was that higher education, as all levels of education, would be free for all those that had the ability to pursue it independently of their financial condition, is what we call in Greece dorean paideia. And the translation is free education, but just let me say that dorean comes from the word doro, which is gift, something more than just free. In the decades since then, Greece has had its ups and downs. Many things have changed. Priorities have changed. Greece is now in its worst position in the recent history. But one thing is still unchallenged. And this is the notion of dorean paideia, of free higher education, that is now rooted in the psyche of Greece, equally perhaps as democracy itself. One of the first acts of the dictatorship in 1967 was to completely overturn the education reform of 1964, with one exception, and this was dorean paideia. Dorean paideia, free education, is now embedded in the Greek constitution. However, higher education today in Greece, despite the successes of individual bright young people, is at a low level, as many other sectors are. But I'm not here to talk about Greece's higher education problems. What I want to try to do is to view these problems in a more general setup that will allow some lessons to be drawn for all those who care about public universities. My comments will reflect my experiences in all three capacities that influence policies in higher education: as a professor for more than 30 years, as a university administrator, and as a minister responsible for higher education and research. Higher education is a complex social structure. The key players in this social structure are the students, the faculty, the university leaders, and the policy makers. The public is indirectly involved, mainly through the students. The main issues preoccupying these key players are access, quality, cost, and need for social mobility, the need for social mobility. What complicates things is that any policy decision regarding any of these issues has an impact on the other three that is difficult to control. To make things harder, the different players place different emphasis on each of them. Let me just show you in a simple way how I envisage the relation of those issues and policy decisions associated with them. We have the four aims: cost, access, quality, and social mobility, and the policy decision. The shape can take different forms depending on the social conditions in different countries and at different times. The closer one edge is to another, the easier it is to satisfy both corresponding ideals simultaneously. The farther away one edges from another, the harder it becomes to optimize both, and the more extreme and painful the trade-off becomes. This shape and this situation can take dramatic changes at a period of an economic crisis. Of course, in an ideal world, all points will concentrate at one point.
In Greece, in the 1960s, when the policy decision was made to offer free education for all, access was low. We had only two universities. This made it possible to maintain quality. As years passed, especially after 1996, Greece followed the international trend to mass higher education that has since become universal higher education. This was politically attractive, but had a negative effect on quality. Quality dropped. Even worse, social mobility declined. Greece has now the second highest unemployment rate of graduates in the European Union. Social mobility is a strategic target. Free higher education and access are tools to achieve social mobility. So, the strategic target of the policy of free higher education was compromised while the tools for achieving it remained in place. To justify a free higher education and to maintain access, all education policies were formulated with one aim: to serve equity and not equal opportunity. This has led to total uniformity, to the detriment of excellence. Uniformity has gone to extremes, even at the expense of talent. To give you just an example, in the name of uniformity, a bright student that had completed his 4-year degree in 3 years could not graduate by law until 4 years elapsed. Clearly, the policy has failed. And it is not easy to change the situation because of the trade-offs and especially because of the financial crisis. Now, the creditors of Greece are asking for painful decisions. They want to closing down of departments and of universities. Remember, I said that when Dorean Paideia was introduced, free education in 64, we had two universities. Now we have 40 higher education institutions. So you understand what the problem is when the taxpayer has to cover all the expenses for all these institutions. As if the above were not enough, the public is very negative today towards universities and their leadership, believing that they are not serving their mission and that they live in their own ivory tower. There are many accusations of lack of accountability and transparency in universities. And when you lose public support, you are in danger of also losing the support of the policymakers. Before I make some remarks from the lessons from Greece, let me just point out some similarities and differences that I see between Greece and California. Both in Greece and California, we cherish public higher education. We also promote social mobility. And of course, Greece and California are going through a serious financial crisis. But probably this is as much as Greece and California share as far as higher education is concerned. The differences are important, and I think these differences make California and the public university system in California much more viable and less susceptible to difficulties that we are facing in Greece. In Greece, like in many European countries, we have a centrally controlled system, while here decisions are taken at the university level with accountability, which is important. In Greece, as in most European countries, we are controlling input, while here you are evaluating output. salaries in Greece of all personnel are paid by the state. Also, the student numbers are decided by the state. And importantly, the emphasis in Greece is on equity and access, while here in California is on equal opportunity and excellence. And things become even more difficult when there are other policy decisions that are the result of other priorities. For example, here in California, in the United States, and in Greece, the healthcare has taken priority. And when you have such a development, then the funding for higher education, for public higher education, becomes less. Having said all that, let me talk about some of the lessons that can be drawn from the experiences in Greece. I think we should not compromise on excellence, even though there will be pressures to narrow down the number of universities pursuing excellence. It is the quality of education which counts, not just the numbers. Always stress the difference between equality and equal opportunity. Don't succumb to uniformity in the name of equality. Do whatever you can to have the public at your side. It is hard, but it is necessary. If you manage it, you improve your chances to have the policymakers on your side. To do this, choose carefully your friends and decide who are those that you don't mind to displease. Promote accountability and transparency to convince the public that their taxes are well spent. Emphasize that social benefits from higher education and social mobility because of higher education are two different ideals. All universities, public and private, contribute to social benefits. For social mobility, it is the public universities that the state can count on. Motivate and assist public universities to increase access for enhancing social mobility and not for collecting more tuition fees. Remember that access has an immediate impact for policymakers. Pursue it innovatively. Perhaps work closer with community colleges. As academics, don't only pursue scientific excellence and good teaching. Understand the more general societal settings and constraints and explain why what you are doing is important. Universities are the places with the highest concentration of experts, professors. However, do not hesitate to admit mistakes. The public appreciate it. Better diversify at a high standard than uniformize at a low standard. And last but not least, always remember that your students are your asset, but also they are uneasy and impatient partners. Finally, a more general lesson. A financial crisis is usually followed by a social crisis. Social mobility is important because it improves social cohesion. In my remarks, I have not dealt with crucial issues such as the influence of distance learning, the importance or not of location, the use of technology, completion rates, etc. I feel that these are important, but only side issues as compared to the main ones that I mentioned. Thank you for listening. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Panaritos. And let me also say thank you to the Chancellor for letting us combine our two series for this event. The series that we've established, the Provost Forums on the Public University and the Social Good, it was just too wonderful to have this opportunity of the guest in the Chancellor's Colloquium, because you've been speaking very much about that. And as we know from our series, this issue that's very much on our mind about how we fund our universities, how we get society at large to appreciate investment in universities, is not restricted to the United States. It's a problem in every, it's a challenge in every country, and the lessons that you've shared with us are ones we'll want to think about. So thank you all for coming. And let me begin by asking you to speculate. You've talked about in your slides how you can balance these different goods of access, cost, quality, social mobility. I think that it's interesting that when we're speaking, we tend not to list social mobility explicitly as a good, but I think that it's a mistake not to do that. My question is, can you give us some advice here for California about how we could optimize that, as you understand our situation, how you think that we could make sure that we're hitting on all four cylinders?
Well, I wish I could. I think this is not this is a question that doesn't have an easy answer. And studying the situation in different countries where they have tried to improve social mobility, I can see that the approach they followed was not successful. For example, I can talk about Ireland. In Ireland, they abolished tuition fees in 1994 or 95. And then they introduced tuition fees a few years ago. Now, they have found out in analyzing their data that the abolition of tuition fees did not helped in advancing social mobility. I think we have a similar experience in Sweden, where there is a study by a professor here, Davis, a professor from economics, I think his name is Evans, if I remember correctly. He has showed that, again, Sweden is a country that has as a main ideal social mobility. And he has also shown that in Sweden they didn't manage to, they didn't achieve that. So I think one perhaps way of achieving that is to place emphasis on the number of students, on the students that you get with lower social background, and to be able to present to the public the value added through your programs. To be honest with you, having been here half a day, I think that what you're doing in Davis is tremendous. I'm impressed, and I have been to many places. I can tell you that. And Linda Katechi knows that I'm not very easy in making compliments. So I think that probably Davis, in a few years' time, may be a leading university, not only in numbers like research money that you get, but in adapting to new social settings and to new social needs.
You spoke about also your role as a minister of research along with higher education. Of course, for a university like UC Davis, a leading research university, research is completely part of our mission, our goal, and sometimes some of the public sometimes imagines that there is a tension between our role as a teaching institution and the research that we do, the role of professors as teachers and professors as researchers. I wonder from the Greek perspective or your experience in European and other universities, how you would address those concerns that some members of the public have.
Well, one thing that I can say is that for all the information that have come to my attention during my term as a minister, and during the meetings of ministers of education and research, ministers of research, because we had different meetings as ministers of education and different meetings as ministers of research, it is proven that good universities, good research universities, cannot be good unless they are good in teaching, and good teaching universities cannot be good unless they are good in research. So research and teaching, contrary to what some people believe, go hand in hand.
You mentioned as one of the things that you didn't talk about was online education. I'd very much like to hear your comments on that and how that is beginning, if it is, beginning to emerge on the European and particularly Greek horizon.
Well, we have the traditional open universities, and we have open universities in most European countries, but I think that things are changing, and I would probably go as far as to say that I have a feeling that the United States may become the next empire because of the distance learning and the innovation there. I see the initiatives with Coursera and the initiative with MIT and the number of bright young people all over the world who attend these courses. So again, I'm sorry to say as a European, the U.S. is going to have an advantage that it will take a long time for Europe to follow. And the advantage will have different repercussions and implications that it will require much more time to discuss.
You've talked in that response, and I know elsewhere we've talked a little bit about the way Europe is looking to the United States, and particularly U.S. higher education, as a model in some ways. I'm wondering what are some of the aspects of American higher education that is so attractive to European educators? And maybe, if it's not too technical, you might refer to the Bologna process in Europe, and the audience might want a little explanation about that.
Okay. I will start with the Bologna process. I think the Bologna process is a policy taken at the European Union level where students from one university and from one country are encouraged to go to other places, but most importantly, of using a Europe-wide higher education area where degrees and qualifications obtained in one country will be recognized in another country. That has taken about 10 years to be completed. In different countries, there were different reactions. Some countries were positive, some others were not positive. Students reacted in some countries, Germany, Greece, Spain. But it is useful to have a tool where you know that if you are a union like the EU is trying to be, it is important that you can transfer qualifications and knowledge from one place to the other. Now, as far as Europe and I think Asia, looking into the United States for examples and good practices, I would say that in some places we have seen that things work in the United States. And for some reason, they don't work well. I mean, if you look at the rankings, university rankings, I think in one of them, 17 out of the 20 top universities are from the U.S. and 53 out of 100. Which is even more important. And We look in research what you do, the fact that you introduced the concept of interdisciplinary research, the fact that you tried to narrow down bureaucracy in submitting research proposals and making the proposals easier to submit. Other issues that the U.S. has tried and they are successful. But my feeling is that we are slow in adapting these changes. And if I can mention one example, one experience that I had as a minister of research, say, it was realized in Europe that it is much easier and much less expensive to get a patent in the United States than in Europe. I think it costs about 10 times as much in Europe to get a patent. So we met as ministers of research to discuss the changes necessary to make Europe competitive. Well, we met 4 times within a year in different places, and we spent 2 to 3 hours each time, probably more, discussing it. And at the time I left, I stopped being minister. We had not resolved the issue. Because the issues were, are we going to have 2 or 3 languages or more? Should all languages be there translated? I mean, all patents should be translated? Should be an automatic translation, electronic translation? How that would be accurate? And then the U.S. is moving forward faster and faster.
Well, I wish it were the case that we never had unproductive meetings. But, you know, when you're talking about research and patents, a lot of our work at universities involves working with industry and with private business. And also there's the matter, which I think is much more broadly established, even for public universities now in the U.S., private philanthropy. And this brings me to a word that we've heard a lot of, privatization. And I know from some of my travels that it's not only a word being discussed in the U.S. So, again, you've been talking about the strong public university tradition in Greece. My understanding is it's actually illegal to have a private university. And, of course, it's in the Constitution that you have free education. I'm wondering what comments you have on what you see as the privatization or this mixed mode of university that we have here in the U.S.
Well, first of all, I don't like the fact, I don't like anything to be forbidden. I mean, to forbid private universities by the Constitution. That means that you are not prepared to compete with somebody. I think public universities, public higher education is very important. And the state and the people will support public higher education. But not to allow any other activity so that you have the monopoly and you are happy with what you are doing, no matter whether what you are doing is good or not, I think that's wrong. Secondly, I think that we've managed, probably in the U.S. too, but in Greece especially and in Europe, this word privatization has gone a very negative connotation. And it is used by those that do not want to see change so that they don't allow change to happen. Mm. The things that come under the umbrella of what is called privatization, they are not supporting, say, the idea of private versus public. They give a public university the opportunity to compete and to be successful. So, well, philanthropy is a Greek word thousands of years now, and some of the most important things in Greek education have occurred because of philanthropists. And we are proud of those. So I would say, if I can make a comment, don't be afraid of words. Try to do what is best for the university. And if you are successful in what you're doing, then the connotation that those that do not like change doesn't matter.
Yeah. Well, I'm thinking the Athenians have been resisting the rich like Philip of Macedon for a very long time. But that leads me to one last question that I want to ask before turning this open to everyone, which is, of course, as the Chancellor mentioned, I'm a professor of classics and comparative literature. So I'm curious as to the role of a whole range of disciplines, particularly social sciences and humanities and arts in the Greek universities. And also, I also know this is something that is being looked at in other countries. We have here a long tradition of wanting our undergraduate students to have exposure to a broad range of topics, including all of the humanities, the liberal arts. I'm wondering what the perspective is on those topics and liberal arts in the Greek universities.
Well, I think the approach that you have is a very good one. I think you need today scientists, people that study in the university, to have a broad view, not just a narrow-minded view of the field that they want to study. Unfortunately, and this is another one of the problems of uniformity that I mentioned before, unfortunately, again, in Greece, probably in some other European countries, but in Greece mainly, we are very narrowed in our studies. So a student who graduates may be very good, say, in physics or in mathematics or in biology, but he doesn't have that broad view that you mentioned that you find in the U.S., which is important. And to give you one example, my son wanted to study to combine mathematics and philosophy. And in Greece, he couldn't do that. Can you imagine that? In Greece, out of all places, not to be able to study mathematics and philosophy at the same time.
Plato would have failed. I'm sure there are questions out here. We have a microphone circulating. I see Carrie over here. Andrew over here. Or I guess we have a microphone.
Professor Panaridos, thank you so much for visiting our campus and thank you for your remarks. My question relates to Dorian Pedia, and I respect and I appreciate free education, and I understand, of course, it is part of the Constitution, not only in Greece, but from what I understand, in many other European countries. Many members of the American higher education system would argue that maybe the two terms that make this expression, Dorian Pedia, may be incompatible with each other. They may question that the lack of having skin in the game, if you would, that maybe the term Dorian Pedia may be an oxymoron. What are your views on that?
Well, now I have to answer you as a politician and not as a professor. Have we made the best out of what Dorian Pedia is? I don't think we have. Would things be different if we didn't have Dorian Pedia, if students participated to a certain extent to the cost of their education? I don't know that. But I have a feeling that there are so many issues that we can confront and resolve without getting into the argument of whether students should also participate in the cost of higher education. Because I feel that if we solve all the other issues in an appropriate way, we can probably keep this unique characteristic of the Greek higher education system. But what I don't like is to use the idea of free higher education, of dorean paideia, in order not to make the changes necessary. I mean, excellence and competition and the seeking the talent is so important. That has nothing to do with dorean paideia. We have to do that. We have talent. You find people here in Davis, you find people at Berkeley, Harvard, UCLA, you name it. These are young people who studied in Greece. They were very good. But I have a suspicion that they are good despite the system and not because of the system.
Please. Let's wait till the mic if you don't mind.
Oh, okay. Dr. Panaretis, thank you very much for being here. On different topics, I'd like to ask you, do you see universities and specifically Greek universities having a more direct role in job creations, in a more impact in terms of working with the government and or also preparing students for the right jobs? Thank you.
Well, I don't think that we have much of that. And one of the reasons is that universities do not have incentives for taking this as a challenge in their mission. Universities and university professors somehow feel that their responsibilities start and end with educating the young people. And there is also some resistance to more cooperation between universities and business, which is not explainable easily, but it's political, mostly political. And how we can... The interesting thing for somebody in politics is to see how to change that, how to make universities have incentives for preparing their students, not just as scientists, but preparing to be able to contribute to society and to find jobs. And I think the only thing I can say is that we have to work harder on that. We haven't achieved what we should have achieved.
Looking for some other Warren.
Thank you very much, Dr. Panaretis, for coming to Davis to visit us and give us some good ideas and comparisons. I think that the word philanthropy comes from Greek, if I'm not mistaken. And I know that there are wealthy families in Greece. I think Mrs. Kennedy joined one of those families, if I'm not mistaken. I wonder if there is a role of philanthropy to the universities of Greece from people like those. Thank you.
Well, there should be, but there isn't. Yet, as part of the changes in the laws regarding higher education, we created, say, the setup, the legal setup, because in a centrally controlled educational system, there should be a law for everything. So, we created the setup for people to be able to contribute to education and to higher education and to education in general. Will that happen? Well, I think, again, we have to work both at the university level and at the political level. For a philanthropist to give his or her money, he has to be sure that the money is used in the best possible way and have an impact on the reason why they are given. We haven't yet convinced the world community that whenever money becomes available, the use of this money is the best one. So, as I said, we have to work harder. We have to improve. And I'm sure that people, not only in Greece, but people from outside Greece, people of Greek descent, but also people who are not Greek, they want to help Greece. They want to help Greece. But they want to help Greece to improve, not just give some money to a charity or to a university or to a school.
Makes me think of the terms you recommended in that list, accountability and transparency. You know, if I might insert a question here, maybe you, in philanthropy, which is one of the sources here, leads me to wonder if you would talk about both how Greek higher education is funded now, and also perhaps talk about that in the context of the current austerity measures and the particular situation of the economy in Europe and in Greece.
Yes. Well, most of the funding for Greek higher education comes from the taxpayer, from the government. And
I mean the ones who pay taxes.
What can I say? Yes, the ones who pay taxes. And there is a certain part that comes from research money, usually from outside Greece, usually from the EU. And Greek researchers have proven that they are good in submitting good proposals and getting research money. So some of this money now is used to finance activities of the universities that are necessary. But I'm a practical person, and I suppose everybody in this room understands that when you have cuts, 10, 15, 20% cuts in budgets, in salaries, you cannot maintain 40 higher education institutions and expect them to do well or to do at least as well as they did, whatever that well was. So there are, in my opinion, there are hard decisions that have to be taken. And I believe that if the creditors of Greece insisted more from the beginning on structural changes instead of insisting on a financial measures with immediate effect, cutting salaries, cutting pensions, Greece would find its way to recovery much sooner. I think Greeks, you know, Greeks work hard. I mean, okay, you have an example here. And there are other examples here. I talked to some people in the morning. They need the right environment, and they need to have the framework to achieve and to use the best of their potential.
Please.
Because you have a monopoly on admissions, are you admitting fewer percentage-wise students to the university level than, say, in the United States, where it's open and we may be over educating people, but we have more? In other words, if a student is a grind and gets an A+, you're going to take them, but a B+ student may not make your qualifications because you have limited slots, and he may be the creative one and is thinking out of the box. So I wonder if you're limiting too tightly the people you do take into the university.
Well, thanks for the question. Because there is another strange thing that's happening in Greece. in Greece, we offer more university places that we have candidates competing for. If I show you the numbers, when we have set up 40 higher education institutions. There are years that some of the places available are not filled. And I mentioned the compromise of quality. One minister a few years ago tried to check. We have a national entrance exam system. Everybody who wants to go to the university has to take this national entrance exam. And according to the performance, they are placed in different departments, in different universities. You know, the top ones go to the medical school, some others go to technical schools, and so on and so forth. So this minister said, we have very low quality university students. Some of them, they get to the university, say, with a score of 4 out of 20 or 3 out of 20. So what she did, she said, I'm going to stop that. I'm going to... she introduced a law that you couldn't get a place in higher education unless you scored at least 10 out of 20. What happened then? I think in those years we had about 15,000 to 20,000 empty spaces in the universities. We had whole departments where the faculty didn't have anything to do. So we were paying, this is strange, we were paying for the faculty, paying for the building, paying for the administration, and we kept people out because they were not very good. And, okay, how can you say, as you rightly pointed out, that these people could not perform well? But this brings another issue which I didn't talk about so far here. I liked what president, the ex-president and the next president of the United States said some time ago, that we need mass higher education. We don't need mass university education. You are very lucky to have here the community college system. You are very lucky. And not just have the community college system, because there are other countries like Switzerland or I think Austria and Germany that they have technical education, post-secondary, a good technical education. But you are lucky because you can have movement in your system. People can go to community colleges, and if they are good, they can go to universities. If they can stay with the qualifications they get, they can go out and get a job. So this is very important, this movement, the possibility, and this contributes also to social mobility much more than having more university places available, I think.
It's one of the things that the Chancellor is very, very interested in and emphasizes here is the importance of international experience. Is study abroad something that Greek students are involved in? Do they seek that? And I might also add, how international are Greek universities?
Well, Greek students more and more realize that getting an international experience is useful. And that has been proven also by the way that they go into the job market. Those who have an international experience, they do much better. Now, again, you also raised the question about universities. Do they have the incentive for being international? Incentive is a word that is missing. And what is associated with incentives? So I wish that Greek universities were more international, not just for bringing more students from different countries. You know that internationalization in higher education is a big business now. Everybody's after international students. In Asia, in Australia, the United States, the UK. But I'm not talking about just money. I'm talking about the importance of being exposed to other cultures, seeing what's happening there, and also explain what is happening in your country. So I wish we had more internationalization. I think it's very important for you here in Davis that you promote that, and I'm sure you will see results of that very soon.
Do I see some other questions? Yes.
Professor Panardo, thank you for being here with us. One question of mine, there is a lot of discussions about how to make education people in order to make people more competitive. But I feel there is not much discussion about how to keep those people competitive. So I want to know your sentiment about lifelong learning programs and whether the state should more actively pursue this kind of programs and the role that the universities can play on this.
I think lifelong learning is one of the most important aspects in education, and for some reason universities do not seem to be very eager to pursue. I don't know why. In Europe, where things are done centrally, there is emphasis in words and in declarations for supporting continuing education. Again, I think you need incentives. Incentives not just for those who are the recipients of continuing education, but incentives of those who offer continuing education. And open universities do that, but I think that's not sufficient. And I also think that it doesn't have to be a formalized degree. I wouldn't be surprised if a few years down the road, especially with distance learning, we see agencies outside the universities. Universities can offer a degree, so that certifies that you are an expert on something. We may see agencies that certify that you have certain qualifications because you studied here, you did some distance learning from there, you had some continuing education at a different institution. So I believe that universities should pursue different avenues that the traditional professor on the podium and teachers in the hall, and students in the hall, sorry, teachers.
Thank you very much. Thanks again to our speaker, and please join us for a reception in the lobby.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.